Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to the Starcast for the week of June 8th, 2025. We've decided to change things up a bit, and we're going to go with two hosts, myself and Mike Lewinsky. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
All right, let's take a look at space weather from spaceweather.com. Mike, what's happening with the sun over the next couple of days?
Well, Jay, mid-latitudes, there is a 25% chance of a minor geomagnetic storm over the next 2 days. Chances of active rising to 35% in the next 24 hours and 40% in the next 24 to 48 hours. So, with the nearly full moon coming up, our chances of really seeing a good show are probably not great.
Yeah, so our full moon is on Wednesday, and the full moon, this first full moon of June, is traditionally called the honeymoon. That's maybe because it's often yellow or even deep yellow or orange. There's probably two reasons for this. First, the summer air is often humid, and humid means hazy, and haze reddens the sun, moon, and stars, especially when we're seeing them through the thick air low to the horizon when the moon is rising. And so that's what kind of makes it kind of golden or honey-colored. So those are kind of the main events in the night sky this week. For this week's discussion, we're going to look at cosmic rays and radiation. So, Mike, why this topic?
Well, Jay, we had an event on June 1st, a very strong aurora display and geomagnetic storm that created it. And that caused a sudden drop in cosmic radiation as registered by the Oulu Cosmic Ray Station in Finland.
So why would it drop?
Well, this is sort of paradoxical. We think there's all this energy coming at us from the sun, all this particle radiation. Surely we should be seeing more radiation here on Earth. But the cosmic rays are brushed aside or swept aside in something that is called a Forbrush decrease, which is named after the American physicist Scott Forbrush, who studied cosmic rays in the 1930s, 1940s. This happens when the CME basically pushes galactic cosmic rays away from our planet. And I tell you, this led me down a big rabbit hole. You know, when we talk about cosmic radiation and cosmic rays, are these the same thing?
Right.
Is the CME that's striking the planet the same as the galactic cosmic rays? Galactic cosmic rays are very high energy particles. So they are a form of particle radiation. And the coronal mass ejection, which is striking the Earth's magnetosphere, is also forms of particle radiation that is coming from our local star. And so it's sort of radiation versus radiation here, right? We have one form of particle radiation from the sun, which is sweeping not just from the Earth, but from really the whole solar system. We record drops in galactic cosmic rays from our detectors, even on probes that are further out in the solar system, on the space station. This has been observed several times, but this particular Forbrush decrease was the most significant for 20 years, more than 20 years. The last time we had this big of a drop-off in cosmic radiation was in October 30th of 2003.
It must be related to the solar cycle, and right now that we're at solar max, right?
Exactly. We seem to be having quite a nice displays of Northern Lights over the last couple of years here, and we can probably expect that to continue for another year or two as Solar Max is not a distinct event, but happens over a spread of years.
Yeah. So one of the things that it's kind of revelatory to me, and also it was kind of when I was trying to figure out the difference between, you know, when we have an X-ray burst from a solar flare, and the difference between that and a CME. And so it was kind of, I learned about the difference between charged particles versus electromagnetic radiation. And so when we talk about CMEs or the coronal mass ejections and or cosmic rays, we're actually talking about charged particles. And and that's different from electromagnetic radiation. And so can you talk a little bit about the difference between charged particles versus electromagnetic radiation?
Yeah, so, you know, with electromagnetic radiation, we are looking at photons, radio waves, microwaves, light, X-rays, and gamma radiation, all in packets that we call photons. Whereas with particle radiation, we're very often talking about electrons, although there are other forms of particle radiation, protons, helium, ions, neutrons, and neutrinos. But it's useful to just say, well, you know, Mike, what's the difference between a photon and electron? Because if a photon is the packet of electromagnetic radiation, electron is an example of particle radiation, a packet of particle radiation. And so it's kind of a fine question. A photon is a unit of traditionally light, is what we think of, that has zero mass and is traveling at the speed of light. Whereas an electron, which would be our smallest unit of particle radiation, has a very small mass. It is matter. It is a particle. And it can never travel at the speed of light. It can travel near the speed of light, but never at it. Whereas the photon is never going to diminish below the speed of light. And as we talk about we're going to get into ionizing radiation next. The electromagnetic radiation, you know, has a spectrum from, you know, radio waves, which are relatively harmless to humans, up to, you know, gamma radiation, which is, of course, you know, famously very, very damaging. And with the electromagnetic radiation, it really depends upon that frequency, which determines the damage or the danger of the radiation. Whereas with, you know, particle radiation, things are a little different. And, you know, now the speed is going to be more of a factor of that particle in terms of how damaging it is.
Yeah, and that's also with charged particles. Well, for example, 90% of cosmic rays are actually protons, and about and then 9% or so is usually helium ions, which is basically alpha particles, and then there's, you know, various other particles. And so that actual mass and speed of the charged particles is what contributes to their basically damaging effects on, you know, the possible hazardous effects on life.
Absolutely.
And so,
and there is a line there between ultraviolet and X-rays, where with the higher energy particles. It is possible, or higher energy electromagnetic radiation, excuse me. We have the risk of damage to atomic bonds and creating free radicals or reactive oxygen species that we actually break up, and we get an atom that's missing an electron, and that is going to go on to steal an electron from another atom. And that line between, you know, ultraviolet and above, at ultraviolet levels, ultraviolet radiation is not strong enough to break the atomic bonds that way, but it can cause molecular bonds to decay. And so that's how we come up with a sunburn. So the damage that we experience from sunburn versus an X-ray, really, it is related to the strength of that radiation and the ability of whether or not it can knock electrons off of an atom, or whether it can just do damage to molecular bonds.
Yeah, and it's that high energy that, you know, allows it to penetrate. And, you know, so if we use the example of a human body, of course, is ultraviolet radiation. You know, so we can definitely get, you know, you can get skin cancer from ultraviolet radiation, but that radiation is pretty much blocked, you know, by your skin. It doesn't actually penetrate. Whereas we get into a higher energy radiation like gamma radiation, and that actually affects your internal organs because it's actually penetrating into into your body.
Exactly.
And so can charged particles have ionizing radiation?
That's a really good question, JJ.
okay, I'll answer it myself. Yes, and so it's sort of the pinball metaphor, is that what happens if you actually have a particle, which is a neutron flying through space at high energy, it's actually an ion. So it's looking for electrons to mate with, and so when that penetrates our atmosphere, and most of it is actually absorbed by our atmosphere, but it can actually cause, you know, a pinball effect where it's a neutron will hit an oxygen atom and knock off a couple of electrons, and then we'll get some electromagnetic radiation from that. But also, you know, the fact that a particle can actually, you know, penetrate your skin, and it's an ion looking to ionize things. And so this is kind of leads to one of the main dangers for our astronauts in space. And so a lot of this charged particle and EM radiation is absorbed by our atmosphere. And so if we look at it, in fact, it's probably, if you have a certain amount of radiation at, let's say, ground level or, you know, sea level, is that, even if you go up to a high mountain, like a 15,000 foot mountain, that's doubles your radiation exposure from radiation from space. And then we can look at, if you're flying in an airplane at 30,000 feet, that's four times as much radiation as you're being exposed to. And then when you get to space, it can be as much as, 250 times more radiation than sea level at the space station, up to like 700 times more radiation if you're in, outer space. And so this is one of the huge risks to space travel and astronauts in space.
Yeah, and just one correction there, Jay. I think you said four times for aircraft at 30,000 feet. It should be 40 times. So okay. Flying during solar storms, that number goes up.
So this is one of the big barriers that we have for actual like travel to Mars, you know. And so, you know, it seems that unless we can find some ways to mitigate this, is that we're basically telling these astronauts that they're, you know, they're at a high risk for, you know, a shortened lifespan. And, you know, maybe the trip to Mars is a one-way trip.
Yeah, that's certainly, you know, unless and until we can find a good way to shield astronauts from some of that radiation. And I've heard proposals to, you know, create bulkheads that are filled with water. Of course, we're going to need to take, you know, a good bit of water with us, you know, not just for the journey, but to have, you know, as operations get started. So I don't know that that's, you know, we might be able to mitigate that risk somewhat with a, you know, bulkhead filled with water. It's certainly not going to eliminate, you know, all of it.
Well, lifting water into space is what the most, you know, they basically say, you know, that's why we can't really colonize space, is because most of the things that we want to colonize, if we want to colonize the moon or if we want to colonize Mars, it's basically prohibitive to launch water into space and to, you know, to because of just sheer mass. And of course, the mass is what we would use from the water to shield from radiation.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, any discovery of, you know, sources of water on the moon are so exciting, at least one of the reasons, you know, because it would take a lot less energy to lift that water off of the moon if we could establish, you know, a operation there to, you know, mine it and refine it, or purify it rather. And I don't know if you ever watched the show For All Mankind, but that's, you know, a plot point there. And that's a big part of the reason why they are looking for water on the moon. And that becomes a really pivotal point. And I don't know, it might have been season three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, you know, any, you know, colonization of the moon, you know, the main, you know, thing is that just for the amount of radiation that the moon receives, more than the Earth does, that they, you know, that the only viable way to colonize would be to be basically burrow underground.
Exactly. And using those lava tubes, maybe, starter holes.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, lava tubes. And also there was a article I referred to a couple podcasts ago about actually how radiation can form water on the moon. And they were saying that some of the, you know, the solar wind, those particles were, you know, basically hydrogen protons that would hit oxygen in the moon rocks and form water. And they say that there is short-term water on the moon caused by this radiation, but then that water immediately evaporates off into space. And so one of the things that they were looking at in this study was how do we keep that water in the moon.
Okay. Yeah, that certainly would be, you know, a game changer if we could develop some technology to capture that. And I know that, you know, there's the solar wind and electric wind, you know, a lot of, like, Venus is thought to have had the solar wind basically stripping off oxygen from the Venusian atmosphere. Venus may have had a pretty comparable atmosphere to Earth at one point. And this process is happening to us as well. We are losing some of our water to space. It's just not nearly as at the same rate or as catastrophic as it is for Venus being closer to the sun.
Yeah, we don't realize, you know, what a the, you know, the classic Goldilocks situation that we have here on Earth is that we have such, you know, ideal conditions with our magnetic field that protects us from all this cosmic and solar radiation. And one of the things that is, has been in the news this week has been, you know, talking about how our magnetic fields are shifting and moving all the time, and our actual poles are moving. Our magnetic poles are moving within the Earth at a fairly, you know, rapid rate. You know, we're talking miles per year. And there was a recently published study that I read on science.org, and I guess in the Science Advances, published a story about the pole shift 40,000 years ago. And they said that in the study that the magnetic field strength was reduced by 90%. And so that was causing auroral events and geomagnetic storms as far, you know, into the equatorial regions.
Yeah, that's really a fascinating paper there, and the implications for human and Neanderthal evolution are pretty interesting.
I kind of, you know, kind of take this with a half a grain of salt, but, you know, is yes. that they were, you know, in this study, they were inferring that from this that, you know, that since there were such higher radiation levels, that humans were, Homo sapiens were using ochre as a sunscreen to protect them from the higher radiation, and moving and living in caves and to protect themselves from the radiation. And the study went on to kind of say that, well, the Neanderthals were not doing this, whereas the Homo sapiens were having like tailored clothes in the sense that they were, you know, sewing the hides to fit their bodies. And using ochre and living in caves. And so I don't know if that seems to be pretty speculative, but that may have affected, you know, the actual population of you know, led to the extinction of Neanderthals.
Yeah, and, you know, I agree that, you know, there's definitely some, you know, speculation. It goes further into the co-occurrence of cave art that started appearing around the time of this Les Champs event. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but that's the weakening, dramatic weakening of the Earth's geomagnetic field. And they also talk about portable art and musical instruments evolving during this period. You know, how much of that was just coincidental versus how much of it might have actually been caused by the weakening of the geomagnetic field, I think it is difficult for us to know that for sure. But it is interesting to speculate for sure.
I guess the kind of the end game for us would be to encourage everybody to use sunscreen this summer to protect yeah. themselves from ultraviolet radiation, and maybe consider not doing too much space travel or air travel during geomagnetic storms.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll go ahead and wrap this up, and we want to thank all of our listeners for checking out this podcast. Be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about. You can also check out Mike's website at wildernessvagabonds.com and mine at skylapser.com. Our intro music was Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. From the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in Crestone, Colorado, this is Jay Schaefer and Mike Lewinsky wishing you all clear skies.